Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A couple of things before we get to David Leinhardt. First, a correction from earlier this week. We had a guest on our segment about the Day of Rage Against Crime who incorrectly stated that Major Hassan at Fort Hood had been on the FBI's terror watch list. He had not, which might make it worse, probably given that what we've been learning about him. But to make the correction, he had not been on the terror watch list before he allegedly went on a shooting rampage at Fort Hood. And what's the best question to start a great family conversation at Thanksgiving? Later in the show, David Isay from StoryCorps will be here to preview the National Day of Listening this holiday weekend that StoryCorps is involved with, and he'll give us some of his best questions for starting a great family conversation on or around Thanksgiving. Meanwhile, we are collecting yours to share them with each other. What's the best question to start a great family conversation? Post yours to our Brian Lehrer Facebook group or post it to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll read some of them on the air in about an hour with David Isay. Right now, New York Times economics columnist David Leinhardt is with us to talk about some of his recent thoughts and reporting on insured people left out of the health reform bill, on the pessimism bias that could be making us too down on our economic prospects right now, and on the president considering a follow-up to the Cash for Clunkers program, Cash for Caulkers. Hey, David, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Happy early Thanksgiving.
To you, too. And I want to get to all three of these things because you've been so provocative lately. And let's begin with Cash for Caulkers.
Absolutely.
An idea that you say President Clinton has been promoting to President Obama. What is it?
Yeah, so the phrase comes from John Doerr, the venture capitalist in California, who is on this outside board of Obama advisors. And the Clinton and Doerr ideas are a little bit different, but they also have a lot in common. And so the basic Cash for Caulkers idea is that the same way we gave people an incentive to trade in their car for a new car, which led to a lot more car sales this summer than otherwise would have happened, it was a form of stimulus, we should give people money to weatherize their homes. And the real advantage of this is that it gets people to spend money in the short term in order to save money in the long term, because most of us could save money by weatherizing our homes. The disadvantage, as I described in the column, is that weatherizing your home is pretty complicated. And I just had an audit on my own home, and it's not exactly obvious what you should do. I still haven't decided what I'm going to do. And so my concern about a program like this is that if it's going to work, I think they need to figure out a way to make it simple enough so that we don't feel overwhelmed by the uncertainty and choices involved in weatherization.
In fact, your own situation led to what I thought was a very interesting proposal, because there would be a credit that people would get toward weatherization of their home. But still, weatherizing is a cash outlay right now that could save you money in the long run over lower heating bills. But you figured out that it would take 10 years for you to make up the difference, and you don't know if you're going to be in your current home for 10 years. So your proposal to deal with that is?
Well, so now economists would say that, in fact, if I do it, I'll get more when I sell my house. I'm not sure the market is quite as rational as they think. So the proposal that I talked about, which does come from the Bill Clinton proposal, is this idea, which New York State has just passed a law to make it easier to do, that you can essentially add the cost of your weatherization to your long-term property bill. And that has two fundamental benefits. One,
property tax bill?
Property tax bill, I'm sorry. One, you don't have to lay out the money now, right? It's like putting it on a credit card, but a credit card without a particularly high interest rate. And two, it means that you're splitting the cost with any future owner. So if you are amortizing this over years, which these proposals are designed to help you do, then you don't have to worry so much. Instead of paying $4,000 now, what you're doing is essentially you're agreeing to some kind of annual payment that you would hope is actually less than the savings you're going to get from energizing your home, from weatherizing your home and using less energy.
And as federal policy, Cash for Caulkers would work the same way pretty much as Cash for Clunkers, which was really money right in your pocket if you were going to buy a car.
Yeah, they haven't figured out the details yet. What John Doerr wants to do is basically create incentives for Home Depot and Lowe's and folks like that to get involved. So then they will take over a lot of the promotion, and the government won't have to. The stimulus can piggyback on this private marketing. And ideally, Home Depot and Lowe's would also figure out ways to make this simple enough that people would do it. But I do think I'm very sympathetic to this idea of pushing weatherization. In many ways, it is the perfect kind of stimulus. I think a lot of the people involved in this area, both advocates and government officials, as well as people in the private sector, they don't understand how complicated this is for the rest of us. And I think they need to spend more time simplifying it for all of us. Otherwise, I don't think a weatherizing program is going to end up being that successful. After all, we already have a tax credit for weatherizing in the original stimulus, and a lot of people just find it too complicated to figure out what to do with.
Remember when the original stimulus bill was supposed to be all about green-collar jobs to retrofit America for the global warming era? I mean, that was the campaign promise, but it almost completely disappeared when it hit the ground. What happened to that as a central focus for the original stimulus bill? Remember that?
Yep. I think in part it was always more political than substance. In part, the green jobs was more of a good line to help people focus on what tomorrow's jobs are going to be, and it's always hard to know what tomorrow's jobs are going to be. That actually connects to one of the other columns you mentioned. But I also think that when the economic advisors got to Washington and looked at how to stimulate the economy quickly, they realized that, in fact, there are not hundreds of thousands of jobs out there, green jobs, that if only they flip a switch, they can get off the ground. And that if what you care about is stimulating the economy sooner, a much easier way to do it is to send money to states and to prevent the layoffs of teachers.
Right.
And things that aren't as tangible but actually help the economy more quickly.
I guess that's understandable. I mean, the original idea sounded so good because it not only was going to stimulate the economy in the short term, in theory, but it was also going to do this kind of FDR, WPA kind of infrastructure building for the long term. And yet I can understand it, because what the stimulus has wound up doing is saving all these police officer jobs and teacher jobs, as you say, in communities around the country. And we see more and more how the states and the localities are sinking under the weight of the local deficits. And I guess maybe it would have been hard to watch all these caulkers getting jobs while teachers and police officers were being laid off en masse, right?
Yes, although I think they could have done, I agree with all that, I think they could have done better than they did do, particularly on the political angle of this. Cash for clunkers isn't even in the original stimulus bill. It predates that. And so if you try to come up with really big, obvious examples from the Obama stimulus bill that we can think of, oh, there are jobs in that, it's hard to do. And in that vacuum, although the stimulus has basically worked, in that vacuum, instead what we get is all these stories about, oh, they overestimated the job by 10 jobs in this congressional district. And I think they made a mistake not thinking about the politics a little bit more clearly. And it was hard, so I wasn't saying this at the time. In some ways, it's 20/20 hindsight. Mm-hmm. If they had done more to come up with the kind of FDR programs that you're talking about, even if they were relatively small, I think it would have made people a lot more sympathetic now for a second stimulus, which we need. If we could point to, say, oh, look at those, you know, young people in red shirts walking around doing this kind of work, like right. City Year, or look at the, you know, those people in their 50s and 60s doing that kind of work as part of the stimulus. I think if they had done that, they would have made the stimulus more popular than it is, and it deserves to be more popular than it is.
New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt, my guest on WNYC, and Karen in Edison has a Cash for Caulkers question. Hi, Karen.
Hi there, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling to find out if tankless water heaters and tankless heating systems, where the water is on the heated water is on demand, that's been mandated since 1996 in Canada, is that a part of the weatherization, or is that a green energy thing? Because the fact that we don't have them, and it's the biggest sucker, the water heaters. It's summer, winter, doesn't matter. You got to heat 30, 40, 50 gallons every day, all
Boy,
day.
That's a very specific question. And David, I know you wrote about, like, insulating the water heaters, right? Putting the hot water heaters, putting insulation around them so there isn't as much heat loss from the unit itself.
Yeah. Yes, but that's you will find my knowledge on this stuff is quickly exhausted, which in some ways is part of the point of the column, right? I mean, I'm not an energy expert, and most of us aren't energy experts. And when we're confronted with this, so I don't know the answer to the caller's question. I apologize, but when we're confronted with all these weatherization options, a lot of times we just say, "Okay, I think I'll keep my money and spend it on something else."
David Leinhart, economics expert, not a handyman. My guest on WNYC.
So I'm a real New Yorker. My version of helping around the house is calling the super.
Yeah, right. I know about that. Let's go on to the health reform bill, which you've been watching closely. You wrote recently how people covered with health insurance at work are left out of the insurance exchanges that would be set up for those without insurance. Why do the insured need to be included since they are, by definition, already insured?
Well, there are two real reasons. One, there are a lot of people out there who aren't happy with their health insurance. They have employer-provided health insurance, but they find their insurer incredibly difficult to deal with, or it costs more than they would like, or it covers things they don't care about and doesn't cover things they would like to have covered. They cannot switch. They are restricted to the choices that their employer gives them. In some ways, they are operating in a little bit of a monopoly or close to a monopoly. And this bill won't really do anything to help those people, even though Democratic leaders in Congress have claimed that it will in email blasts. And I think that's a real mistake because I think people deserve to have more choice. And I think we just know that markets function better when people have choices. If you don't like your cable company and you can switch over to a phone company to get TV, your cable company is going to start to treat you just a little bit better, maybe still not well because you only have a few options, but better than they did when the cable company was your only option.
Right.
And I think we would get a much better functioning health insurance market in all sorts of ways if people had more choice.
Because how many people do we know who are insured at work who are among the most frustrated people when it comes to health insurance? Not that it's not better than being uninsured, but the premiums go up, you have almost no say in it. The copays or other payments go up, you have almost no say in it. And at most employers, except for very big employers, they don't really offer you a choice of plans.
Right. And both big business and labor don't like this idea because although they complain about health costs, they actually like the amount of money that they control in order to pay for insurance. Right now, all that money, which economists will tell you is really your money, your employer doesn't pay you income, they pay you compensation, which includes your health insurance. And right now, employers and unions get to control that money, and that brings a fair amount of benefit to them. And so they've really fought this.
And Senator Ron Wyden has some kind of amendment along these lines,
yes,
though?
He has been a lonely voice in the wilderness, along with essentially all economists who study healthcare, pushing this idea. And he's gotten a very small bit of it into the current Senate bill, in which a small number of people with high premiums would be allowed to choose their own health insurance. But the reason it's good news is sometimes these things start small. And so the fact that we might get any version of this into the bill, I think, is actually good news.
I want to mention what you call in your column the biggest single difference between the House and the Senate bills. And here we may have a little disagreement. At least I'm skeptical of where I think you come down on this. The so-called Cadillac insurance tax.
Yes.
And I have serious questions about that idea. I mean, to me, it's a paradox that the Democrats are promising better coverage for all in the light of what we were just saying about people at work who feel like, you know, covered at work, who are being nickeled and dimed all over the place for more premiums, more copays, more limits. But then their bill discourages insurance plans that are actually comprehensive by taxing them. But you think this is a great idea. How come?
I do, and I recognize that it's not always that easy to explain. Let me tell a very brief story about something that happened in California to illustrate why I think it's helpful. In California, a number of years ago, the University of California, so this wasn't just for professors, it was for everyone who works there, janitors, secretaries, all sorts of people, put in place a plan that began charging more copays for insurance plans. There had been a plan that basically covered absolutely every copay. And What happened was there was a lot of switching among the employees. People no longer wanted the plan that essentially had no co-pays but was more expensive. They moved down to a plan that were less expensive. And what happened was the insurers began competing. They realized, wait a second, if people no longer want the high-cost plans, we're going to start delivering them low-cost plans. And when people went in, when economists went in and studied it, what they found is that in the end, the insurers essentially were funding a lot of waste in those high-cost plans. They were funding doctor's visits that didn't matter. They were funding doctors who were ordering treatments that didn't help people. They were funding doctors that charged more. What they found was that there was enormous waste in the system.
But who's going to decide about those treatments that so-called don't help people or doctor visits that are so-called unnecessary? I mean, is that the future? If the twin paradoxical goals of health reform are to cover everybody but save money at the same time, that our future is more people covered but with fewer benefits in the package for each person?
No, the people should still decide. So I think it should work a little bit more the same way every other market works, right? Who decides what car you're going to get? You do, based in part on the price. And one of the problems with healthcare right now is that people are not sufficiently price sensitive. And that feels really good. We think, well, that's great. I never want to be price sensitive with healthcare. I just want to be able to get all the healthcare that I want. And I like the fact that we don't pay any taxes on our health insurance, which is what the Cadillac tax is designed to fight, because then I never have to pay for any of my healthcare. But when we're all doing that, and when we're all going out and essentially getting so much healthcare that we pay almost twice as much as people in other rich countries that are healthier than us, what happens is that it isn't that good a deal. Instead of feeling like we have this wonderful all-you-can-eat healthcare buffet, what we really have is a situation in which we're subsidizing massive amount of wasteful care.
Right. Well, I only hope that when these incentives kick in, whatever they are, it'll really knock down the unnecessary care rather than the necessary care that for some reason or another will help the insurance companies or the providers save money. We have a minute left, and I want to just touch on the idea of this pessimism bias that you referred to. Now that the economy is at a decades-long bottom, everybody sees the future as only being dreary, and you compare this moment to 1982. How come?
1982 was also the bottom of a terribly deep recession. It was also, as we're about to be, the second year of a new president from a new party. And people looked forward, including the economists who were quoted in the New York Times, and basically said, the economy will never recover, or roughly that. They said, this time is different. We're not going to get a recovery. It's going to be terrible. We're going to be saddled for years. And within a year or two, the economy was growing at a speed that it will never grow during this recovery because the Fed was cutting interest rates and they have no more room to cut it. But the broader point is that if you look back in history at the end of deep recessions, 1992, 1994, what you see is an enormous amount of pessimism. The New York Times ran a series in 1996 called The Downsizing of America. And, of course, 1996 was on the cusp of this great jobs boom. Newsweek ran a cover called Corporate Killers about all the CEOs laying off people. And my point was not that I think the economy is going to do really well over the next 2 years. I don't think it'll do that well. My point was just that it's much easier to see all the reasons the economy won't do well and to miss the reasons that it will do well. In 1993, people weren't saying, hey, guess what? There's this thing called the Internet, and it's going to be really great. They were instead focusing on the problems. And I was just trying to remind people with that column that there's probably good economic news that we can't see right now.
So at the end of the decade from hell, as the new Time magazine calls it, and we'll talk to the writer of that article next hour, comes perhaps the bottom and a cycling up with economic prospects that we don't even know yet what they will be born from. David Leonhardt, economics columnist from the New York Times. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up tomorrow, a Thanksgiving Best Of show all about food and sports. From Michael Pollan to Monica Seles, we hope to keep you good company while you stuff the tofu tomorrow at this time, or whatever you're stuffing. A lot to listen for every morning at 10, even Thanksgiving Day. And coming up in a minute, we'll have Ethan Zuckerman back with us, who's been doing such interesting work with his group Global Voices. Today, something you may not realize about mobile phones. Stay with us.